Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.
3-10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to Weekend Confirmed. Glad you are here with us. My name is Garnet Lee, and joining us today, we have a very special guest. As previously announced, we're rocking his The Damned 33 t-shirt from Jaeger is Corey, the lead designer on Spec Ops The Line.
Hey,
all the way over from Germany.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, dude. And he knows the show, so he knows what he is in for.
Yes,
so
I do.
He has actually jumped under this bus. We did not throw him there. So when we get to that part, don't blame us. Although it's not going to be a Mitch Gittleman situation, I promise. Not going to be.
Corey and I have been hanging out all morning, actually. He went and did Totally Rad Show with us. So
excellent.
If you want to see that episode, it'll be coming out next week, the same day that Spec Ops The Line comes out.
And I got to see a retail copy.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, we played. It was really fun. And it's going to be a great episode.
I'm curious to see how long that would be Mr. Jeff Cannata's voice there holds out.
Hey, everybody. It's 2N1T, of course, on the Twitters, if you want to follow
and you're
me
trying.
Jeff Cannata. Yeah, voice little. I've been ill.
How's the play going?
Good. Fun. Also, Double Jump this weekend. You're going to be in it.
I'm going to be there.
So if you're listening to this before Saturday night at midnight and you're anywhere near Southern California, get your butt down to the UCB Theater. Check out Double Jump. It's going to be a blast, Garnet. It's going to be in the show this time instead of just referenced. And we did a really fun comedy bit I think you're going to like. I'm really proud of it.
And when it sells out, you can always just go across the street because that's always a happening thing too.
At the Scientology Center?
Oh, my God.
And if you're not listening to this before Saturday night at midnight, thanks for coming to the show.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Great turnout. All right. It was awesome. Could you believe that time that, you know.
When you said that thing.
Oh, my God. It was amazing.
By it. Yeah.
I know. Right? It was not like when I host the show and walk all over everybody.
This is not your goddamn show, Garnet.
This is not. And down at the other end is the other Jeff, Indie Jeff Mattis.
Yes. And I'm also happy to that I'm probably going to come check out Double Jump as well. I think that'll be a lot of fun. I had a joke that I had planned to.
Oh, you should
I
do
just
that.
Totally,
you should do that.
Flew
joke.
Out of my head just now. So yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Hilarious.
Hi, everybody.
Things that will be contained within this show include, of course, obviously Spec Ops The Line. We're going to talk about that in the second segment. We're going to talk about Unreal Engine and AI and story development and. We will get the, dude, your game is really awesome. How awesome is your game out of the way right now?
Fantastic.
And then we'll move past that. We're also going to talk about Lollipop Chainsaw. I guess you guys are going to talk about, I saw you have Magic on there.
Yes. Duels of the Planeswalkers 2013 has hit. And it's finally on iOS or iPad.
Is it like 1998 or something? Like,
no, it's,
how is that
the
still
year
relevant?
Is in the title of the game.
I know. How is Magic still like.
It's awesome. Dude, the new decks are great. Stop being a hater.
I'm not being a hater. I'm just saying that, you know, it's interesting that a card game can maintain its franchise momentum for so very long. There's not
very, very well.
I mean, they're generations way past from when that thing started.
It is very well maintained, that game. The custodians
clearly.
Of that franchise take it very seriously. They have a lot of passion. And it is one of the greatest games ever designed, I think. That the pure. Mechanics of that card game.
I'm hearing Deckard Cain's voice and the role of the custodians
Deckard
of
Cain.
Magic. The custodians of Magic the Gathering. We are here for their 23rd annual meeting.
Like, what happens? Do they still, like, never mind. I don't even want to think about it.
No, it's a really slick package, though. I am a total Magic noob. I also picked it up the other day, and wow, it's really slick. And it's almost the perfect game for the iPad because it's.
Okay, I veered here, so let's go ahead and just, like, tell me why you're so excited about Magic the Gathering. Because I honestly...
Well, I'm more interested to hear why Mattis is more excited about it, because I love Magic with my whole heart. And you said you're a noob. Do you know how to play? Because that's a great tutorial.
Very basic. Like, so I played a little bit of the last one on PC for just a bit, and that was just single player, right?
No, it had multiplayer as
Oh,
well.
Did it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Maybe I just didn't get that far. Anyway... What really strikes me about the iPad, and maybe it's because I'm carrying it around with me that I feel more compelled to play it because it feels kind of weird to sit down and play a card game at my computer. The art is awesome.
Yeah.
And the controls are really elegant. And it's really like sort of the barrier of entry for me was sort of like, oh, okay, I got to learn these decks. But if you just kind of sit down and pick a deck and stick with it for a bit and you kind of learn and then you move on to the next deck and you're unlocking stuff as you go, it's got this really neat – like you always feel like you're learning something. It's got this really neat progression.
Yeah, you progress actually through the different planes.
Right.
So you start in – it begins with the SH. I can't remember the – but you move on
that's a lead right there. It begins with SH.
But you move on to Innistrad, and then I think Mirrodin is fourth.
All right, so no one knows what these planes are. Give me
there are some people who know.
Other
it.
Than the Magic players, for folks out there who are one stage removed in the prior to Jeff's like looking at it and going, why do people still talk about Magic the Gathering? What makes Magic the Gathering, Duel of the Planeswalkers, well, 2013?
Magic the Gathering as a game in and of itself is wonderfully simple. And then they layer onto that infinite variation. But the variations add complexity, but it adds complexity in nuance rather than in fundamental gameplay mechanics.
Sure.
So you have a very straightforward set of rules that allow for strategy. I mean, it is really a pure strategy game. There's a lot of luck, sure, in how your deck comes out, but how you deal with. I mean, same with poker.
Yeah, but isn't a big part of, and this is a discussion I think we had probably a couple of iterations ago of the video game version of this of Magic. Isn't a significant portion of what's fun about Magic sitting across the table with your buddies and playing cards and having that social interaction?
Well, yes, but there's multiplayer in all versions of this game.
Okay. So what you're saying is that the fundamental mechanic underneath all of that is solid enough that it stands up to a video game translation, even if you don't have that physical like.
I could literally say the exact same thing to you about poker.
That's true.
Poker is so much fun hanging out with your buddies around the table, but there's certain thing that's fun about working on your strategies, learning the ropes in a video version, you know?
All right. Point awarded.
Corey, have you ever played Magic? Are you a Magic guy?
I think my experience with Magic just goes back to the action game that was released a while back, the first-person one.
Oh, yeah.
Actually Arcane worked on. I don't remember the full name of it. So I'm a little bit familiar with the universe, but I'm not the biggest card player, to be honest with you.
Well, they do a lot more with the lore in this version than they did last year. Every time you fight a planeswalker, you get like a kind of a bio on them. There's these sort of almost motion comic cutscenes that happen before you fight each one of them. It's much more, I think, about the world and will lead you down the path of maybe if you're interested in checking out the lore and finding out like who these people are in the relation to one another, which you don't really need to know to enjoy the game, but it's there. And in 2012, it was more on the periphery.
So if someone's hearing all this and thinks, okay, maybe I'm going to give this a shot, does the game provide an adequate foundation for someone who hasn't played the card game before to get into it and start playing it here?
I think it's the second best way to learn how to play behind having someone who really knows sitting down with you and teaching you. Now, which is not easy to find, you know, unfortunately.
And I will say, as good as the presentation is and as great as the artwork is, they're still missing some opportunities there in terms of presentation. Like I think having each of the cards be animated in some way would be pretty awesome.
Like just battle chess?
Just definitely. No. You just pull the card up and you see the little creature, and instead of it just being there static,
take
advantage of the medium a little bit.
Purity of
– well, it feels more like
– purity my ass. Anytime I'm playing a video game, I want to be – I mean there's a reason I'm playing it as a video game. I want to see that stuff. If a fucking dragon breathes fire, I want to see it breathe fire. I don't want to read – your dragon breathed fire for 18 points of damage to all cards that are not shielded with brown. But if they're shielded with green, then
A, that's not what happens. B, you're taking what I'm saying and changing it. Because what I'm saying is one of the pillars of what Magic is are these beautifully painted
cards. Yes, they are.
Cards.
I know. I agree.
And those cards.
The art is fantastic.
Those cards and the artists, like those artists' names for Magic players are.
But couldn't I bring
known.
The art up out of the card and have it do something really cool?
Well, I think
would that be impure?
That's a way of doing it. But what would more likely happen is you'd get a cheesy-ass 3D model doing that doesn't look anything like
it. Look, why do you – like cheesy was not part of the description I gave. I want to see a badass dragon breathing fire. And you're like,
there
we'd probably get cheesy.
Hundreds and hundreds of cards in the game.
Yeah.
And they look spectacular. The paintings look spectacular. Especially on the Retina display, they look just stunning.
Look
and able to blow them up to that size, you really get to see that artwork. And to think that they would be able to have the resources to animate the exact picture of each of those things fighting in the
they did for the cutscenes in that though, the intro stuff, they basically have static art with little moving pieces, and then they'll tweak like the face or the mouth of some creature so it looks like it's snarling or whatever, but it's really not fully animated.
Yeah.
I think extending
like a motion comic.
Yeah, I think extending that into the actual gameplay, especially if you're playing in a digital environment, it would be a great idea.
Do they take advantage of the platform at all, like with the touchscreen? Are they doing anything that's not in like the standard card game?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of what you would expect, I think. You know, you actually flick a card to put it onto the play field.
That's smart.
You know, if you're pulling something into your hand, you literally touch and pull it in your hand. You can drag target lines to whatever you know, creature you're attacking or player you're attacking. So it works as you'd expect it to work. My only gripe with the iPad version is that I tend to miss that you have a little timer in which you can do a window of time that you can do certain things. And because of the way I sort of handle my iPad, my hand is sort of out of place a lot of times to be able to, I need to stop the timer to do an action, whereas if I just have my hand on my controller for my Xbox or on my mouse for my PC, I'm going to be able to do that much easier.
Are you're playing this time on iPad?
I am for now.
It's on Xbox Live too.
2012, I played on the PC all the way through and then started on my Xbox all the way
through. You say all the way through. It has a campaign?
Oh, okay. It has a really cool campaign actually.
Well, that's cool.
And I unlocked all the cards on the PC version, and then I went and unlocked all the cards on the Xbox version. Played the exact same game twice.
So look,
it's awesome.
Sidetracking into like completely weird design stuff. Since you like board games, I'm sure you've hung out or been to like board games and wargaming shops before, right?
Yes. All the time.
Anybody else?
Oh yeah,
sure.
Okay, so every time I think about this, it reminds me, like, well, not every time, but occasionally it brings to mind this game that we used to play all the time. Because I went, but I was never willing to jump into like the painted miniatures thing. That was like too much, and card games never took me. But there was this game that we used to play. It was called Ace of Aces, and it was this really cool game where each player got a flip book. And it was a dogfighting game. Mm-hmm. Okay, and keep following with me. We'll be done really quickly here. And what it was you started off with two planes coming at each other, and just like a choose your own adventure, you at the bottom of the page on each person's page was a, if you want to turn right, turn to this page. If you turn left, turn to this page. And you cross-reference them with each other so that you engaged in a dogfight by choosing maneuvers and then flipping pages. It was really, really, really cool.
It
reminds me a lot of the tactical combat that was in Skies of Arcadia, if you remember back on the Dreamcast, with the giant ships, you know, and you would like choose which way you went. I would like to see more cool elements like that of really good game design and how they could be translated into video game design.
Well, there's a million games like that. There's a million wonderful combat systems.
Yeah, yeah.
Memoir 44 is one of my favorite games. I think you would eat that game up if we played it. It basically simulates the entire World War II over numerous campaign books that
they've
come out with.
I would eat that.
Very simple rule set that is infinitely expandable. Really, really slick. But there's a million. Wargaming in and of itself is like crazy. Crazy.
Have you guys played that Risk where you guys like
Legacy.
Actually tear up cards and stuff like that? Yeah, I was watching some developers at Jaeger play that. Pretty
where
interesting.
Where you tear up cards?
Yeah, you like actually have like resources and when you lose, you
You lose?
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually mentioned this on the show a while back. It's a game that's meant to be played. It's called Legacy, Risk Legacy, and it's meant to be played by the same group of people over up to 15 games. So, and each game, it will remember what you've done before. So what you've done before has relevancy on the next game. So
dude, there
for example,
fist fights by the fifth game.
Well, for example, like it'll tell you to take a permanent marker and write on the board. Or it will tell you, as you said, to tear up a card. Or there are packets in the game box that say open on game 6. Or winner of the game gets to open this box. Or whatever. And so by game 15, the game you everybody buys the same game in the store, but by game 15, our game is going to be completely different than somebody else's game.
Meta.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
It really made a big splash in the board game world, and it's
– Well, that brings in that whole permanency thing, and now that we've completely sidetracked the show, which by the way, Corey, you know this happens all the time, so
yeah,
you're following right along
with
us.
I'm okay with that.
We were talking about in the outside in the lobby, we were talking about this whole difficulty in games thing because we want to talk about Cliff's commentary, but to go on a little bit different side of it, this permanency thing obviously really – electrifies people's attention, right? It like really gets you into it. It's something that games, though, have sort of swung the other way, because a lot now we're very much about like, how do you overcome the death penalty, right? You don't want to like penalize players for dying. At the same time, I don't know, how do you feel? Are you playing? Are you going to play hardcore the first two level 60s all the way through Diablo 3 completed on hardcore? That's pretty badass.
Yeah, it's
that is really
badass.
Really badass.
It's the most badass.
But you know, as I hit Act 2, I mean, maybe I'm not exactly sure why Diablo 3 hasn't clicked with me. It clicks with me, but not quite as strong as prior ones. I mean, I'm going to finish through one run, and I'll probably start another run in another character. But I'm going to start – I think once I get to those other runs and characters, I won't be exclusively Diabloing 3 anymore. I'll be like, I'll go and – like, and the thing I like about it over an MMO is that I can just go play some Diablo when I want to. Yeah. And it like it doesn't change, and you know what you're getting. Which, speaking of – like, I'm sorry, my really scattershot today. How the hell did that game take 5 years to make? Now that I've played it through Act 1, it is just fucking Diablo 3. It's not anything special. Like, what the hell were they doing for all those years?
I'm sure they tried a whole lot of things.
And then they went back to, by the way, we should do Diablo.
I mean, it's – I think it's substantially different than 2. I mean, the whole skill system is pretty awesome.
Granted. Okay, there are underlying elements that they didn't do. But as far as like building up the engine and doing art and resources and that sort of thing, it's Diablo. Come on.
Well, I mean, yes.
And it's the game it needed to be. It's the game it needed to be. And I've been thinking about this a lot also as I think about my criticism of Halo 4, you know, because my criticism of Halo 4 was, well, it's Halo 4. And I was hopeful that it would be maybe more adventuresome. But then
but it's a
that's not what anyone
–
that's
if
not
you don't kind of situation.
That's very true.
With all these franchises.
That's very true.
If it wanders too far afield, then all of a sudden
– I tell you one thing that I really, really, really miss is I know this is one of my connection points that's not working – is not being able to improve my prime attributes when I level up. That bugs me.
Really?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
That's what gear is for.
I know it's what gear is for, and I realize the mechanic.
This is a gear-based game. Make no bones
about
it.
Dude, it's always been a gear-based game.
Yeah.
It's always been a gear-based game, but what they did was they simplified it, because it used to be that you were running two simultaneous manners of tweaking your attributes. So if you wanted to play a tweener character, you had level up parameters where you could do some baseline improvement, and then you could constantly be playing with the graph by doing different gear mixes.
It's so much better and so much more accessible to people to just say.
It's more accessible. I'll give you it's way more accessible.
I think that equals better for me. But I want to address your other point.
Because you don't make the mistake of, oh, I put 5 points in dex and 2 points in strength and 1 point in
con.
What
does that matter? Like, yeah, let my gear do that, and it's fun to buff myself up with my gear. But what is that? I mean, I don't want to play a spreadsheet. I'm not.
But it's not. Whoa, you're doing the same thing with gear.
No, I'm not, because I'm not. I mean, I am in the sense of what one gear is better than another gear.
They're
but I'm
still
not
showing me dex, strength, con, intelligence. They're just giving me only one way to fuss with it, as opposed to multiple ways to before.
If
you're worried about resetting it, just give me an instant reset button and stop worrying about like, oh, we need to charge the player every time they want to reset their level ups. Really, why?
Wait, what?
The whole theory about, like, you know, if I'm giving you the ability to get 5 skill points every level, and you get 10 levels in and want to reset, that I need to charge you somehow for them to be some sense of
they
importance.
They got rid of that.
Right. I'm saying just get rid of it. Charge if you want to. Let me still have my power up. Let me still have some control over and sense of accomplishment.
You do. It's so much more interesting to be able to say, what's my loadout? And be able to constantly mess with that. And then once you get to 60 and you're worried about Nephilim Valor buffs, not being able to mess with it. So I figure out something that works in multiple situations. But I want to speak – because you're on crack today and you're all over the place. I want to speak really quick. I know we're totally dominating the conversation. But I want to speak to your other point, because if I can friggin' remember what it was, about Diablo and the thing you brought up before about the game.
Dying?
What?
Dying?
Oh, dying.
Dying. I'm never going to bring
difficulty?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. So 1.03
yes.
Patch came out, which was supposed to nerf Inferno Acts 2 through 4.
Yes.
I'm here to tell you Act 2 on Inferno is still very hard. Very hard. We're all excited because, you know, we've been just farming Act 1, basically farming the butcher for lame ass yellows that we can't use because everything in the auction house is better, and And we were all excited about, oh, finally we get to go into Act 2. Well, it's still kicking our ass. And yes, I'm undergeared. And it's great that we can now see item level. That is a huge, huge, huge help. But the good thing that they've done now is made – you don't just need to farm bosses anymore. The fact that you'll get guaranteed yellow drops if you have the 5-stack of Nephilim buff off of just any elites – it really changes the game because now we're just replaying all of Act 1 and having a great time.
I promise you, he is still speaking English.
It's only because you don't understand it. You can go off on a tangent on something that you understand and nobody else does. You can talk about freaking what's her name in Soul Calibur and you know, counting freaking frames and shit, and no one cares.
I'm just giving you a hard time. I understand anyway. The Nephilim Valor and what you're trying to say as far as – didn't they make it to where you stopped farming them because the return is lower for each time you go back to bosses?
Well, that's the thing is that it's not about just killing bosses anymore. Now you can just – as long as you get that 5-stack up, you can kill just elites, yellows and blues, and they will drop – they're guaranteed to drop a yellow
item. I feel like some of what they had to do was a response to the high degree of commercial farming going on inside the game trying to make a buck off Real Money Auction House.
Well, they had to know that was going to happen.
Speaking of which, what are you going to do with those $12?
I am $12 up. That's net, people. That's not gross.
That's
net.
After the cut. That's after the man
after Blizzard
took his cut.
Took yeah. Their 15%.
You know, I've made less money on some actual full games I've ever realized.
Awesome.
Yeah, what do you think about? What do you think about being able? Actually, Corey, as a game designer, what do you think about this idea of giving the player a way to make money playing a game?
I think it's definitely an interesting concept. I think
it's weird.
It's cool that they're willing to try it. I actually, once I get past pre-production, I try to stay away from this type of game because it really just like it becomes a focus, and like I hate sure. not being able to put enough energy into it. but I really think it's cool, and let's see where it goes. It's obviously got some challenges associated with it, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, free to play is basically living and dying by microtransactions.
Yes,
what if
is.
The next iteration of free-to-play is pay you back to play? What if it's free and there's a way for you to sell items and the designers just get a cut? So they're not even the ones selling you the microtransactions. You're selling microtransactions to other people. I mean, it's basically what Diablo is doing. But what if it's layered on top of the free-to-play model? That's like, kind of an interesting idea.
For me, I think it's even better if you get the community actually building stuff.
Like, right. Yeah.
Like Valve's doing that with some of their games. I got some friends that work there, and they see guys coming in to pick up checks for stuff that they released in the community. And that's pretty
really?
Awesome.
Wow. That's really cool.
And so, yeah, I think getting more and more people – I mean, that's how I got into the industry was coming up through the mod scene and stuff like that, just making stuff at home because I enjoyed it. And so, like, that's sort of what you're doing, I guess.
There's certainly kind of, except not. No, no skill and or creativity involved.
Well, you're spending your time at least.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just one more step to take you in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I maybe that's an interesting carrot on the stick of actual work. It's like, hey, there's money to be had here, you know, if you apply yourself. Although I've watched enough of these videos of these guys. Like, I saw this discussion of these two guys who were like, before the game came out, they were talking about they both wanted to be first to 60, first to beat Inferno, mm-hmm. and first to beat Hardcore. And they were like talking about all the crazy shit that they've done pre the game coming out, like reprogramming calculators and figuring out like theory crafting, all this crazy stuff. And I thought to myself, if we can get those guys working on curing cancer, like let's
yeah, something
I mean,
productive.
Come on.
Yeah.
Hey, someone's got to make games.
Right.
Someone's got to make games.
I'm all for it. But it just seems like there's so much energy being put into this in order for a guy to go, yeah, I was the world first guy to get to this. And it's like, what do you get out of that? What is that?
So I haven't touched the auction house myself with a 10-foot pole, but how do you feel about like that, people using a game like that as a profit engine or potentially a profit engine instead of playing it for the game for its enjoyment? It's like, and maybe it's just really at the end of the day, a justification for playing the game. Like, well, you know, I did put however many hours into this, but at least I got whatever, $15 back.
It opens
or $20
a really interesting human psychology experiment, right?
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, do we have the capacity in our mental makeup to say, you know what, I just want to enjoy this, and I know that as soon as I start making money off of it, it becomes something that's that is job-like.
Right.
And even if it's not job-like, my reward is no longer derived from my enjoyment of playing the game. My reward is derived from the actual financial gains that I might derive from selling something that I found. And so now I'm farming, and yet when I'm farming, instead of looking for something to enjoy playing in the game or to do better with or even to show my friends, because look at this freaking badass helm I got, I'm disappointed because the drop that I got is not going to sell but for $2, and I wanted to get the drop that was going to sell
for $4. For the second conversation in this segment, I will bring up poker. Because what is the difference, or gambling in general, between putting a quarter in a slot machine and clicking?
Poker is a game designed for gambling. I mean, it's a skill game, but money has always been involved since poker's inception.
Right.
Applying that to Diablo fundamentally changes how people approach it. You know, everybody may not approach it the same way, but it changes how different people approach it. Like if you're trying to make money off of it, you're not going to approach it as a gamer. Everybody's getting, you know, part of the reason that this 1.03 patch, you know, segments all the new players into an early group is, I think, has something to do with that. Like it's keeping people in a more contained environment so that they're not, you know, being so and so Blizzard can diagnose these people that are sending out these, hey, you know, advertisements basically for farming items.
You said you hadn't gone to the auction house. Does that include the gold auction house?
No, I've looked at them. I haven't done anything with them though.
See, I've stayed out of them at both as well, and I really hope that I can hold to that because I feel, and I'm worried about that.
It's required. It's a required part of the game.
So I don't.
If you want, if
I
don't
like that, here's why. Because I like the idea of being a role-playing game, having my experience based off of my experience in the world, right? And I like the idea of playing with the drops and finds and loots that I get from kills and maybe not having the ultimate gear. Like if I'm playing for a dex build, maybe not having every damn piece of my gear be plus dex gear. Having some pieces that are and some pieces that aren't and learning how to use what I have to be a successful character build. I think that's way more interesting than going back to the auction house a bunch of times and just finding the ultimate best pair of shoulders, the ultimate best pair of gauntlets, the ultimate best belt. Like that,
it rips down the fourth wall of gaming and basically goes, look.
And it's also taking something away from me.
Yeah, you can't play your way to being as awesome as you want to be.
Or it's a different way to play your way.
It is a different way to play it.
Yeah.
This is something that's really interesting to me as well because like trying to add, you know, narrative and emotional rewards in games are
sure.
Just like people are not accustomed to that being the outcome of them doing something in a game. They want a tangible reward. And so that was a challenge actually for us all throughout development was trying to sort of flip that switch in people's brains for them to think about the reasons why they're doing things outside of those tangible rewards. And, you know, and this is – yeah, it's a tangible reward that's breaking the fourth wall. But
right.
I think those reward systems in games are also sort of doing that in a different way as well, taking your focus off of the story or the plot mm-hmm. points that are there. And a lot of times you're making a decision solely based on those rewards.
So how do you
did you think about adding achievement points for emotion? Sadness unlocked.
Maybe Kinect can do that. I'm not sure. But.
Made you cry. Ha ha. 15 gamer score.
Empathy. 20 gamer points.
Oh my goodness. All right. So that's the first segment. We have a very special musical setup. Yes, I did do this to you. This one is also dedicated to my good friend Sterling. So this will be our lead up to talk about Spec Ops here on the other side of this little break. You know what that is, right?
Mortal Kombat, right?
No, that is not Mortal Kombat.
From the movie Mortal Kombat?
No.
That's what I thought it was, too.
I don't know what it's from, but I know it's not Mortal Kombat.
Sandstorm. It's the ultimate dude bro fist pump in Jersey Shore club song and one of the chief environmental antagonists in Spec Ops Alliance.
Yes, it is.
So, Corey, I'll let you take the floor.
I apologize on his behalf.
I had to troll you a little bit. There's a musical troll there.
The music actually in Spec Ops The Line, not blowing any smoke up anybody's ass, is awesome. It's like all like – it starts with Jimi Hendrix. And we were checking it out earlier today. And it's – you guys have a lot of licensed rock and roll tracks.
Yeah, we've got –
it's all like in the scene, right?
Yeah, like we're sort of breaking the fourth wall there a little bit. Basically, there's a character called the Radio Man in the game that's playing songs to sort of – make a twisted commentary on the shit that's going on.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, he's playing some stuff from the 60s, 70s, Vietnam War era and stuff like that.
So since Corey is the lead design from Jaeger on the game, I'm going to let him set things up, give you a quick overview of Spec Ops The Line, because one of the things – and you can – here's a good part, good spot to start from. A couple of years ago – of course, you know, we do those pre-E3 things. 2K had Spec Ops The Line at their pre-E3 event, and then it was at E3 as well, obviously. And all of us like were like, whoa, this game came out of nowhere and looks really cool. And then it just sort of dropped off the radar. And it showed back up about, you know, 2 months ago out of nowhere. I mean, we had been asking all along and we really didn't get much of an answer and didn't really like, – really was never much like – 2K had a lot of stuff going on. I think they were, you know, trying very hard to figure out what the hell to do with XCOM. And that alone was like occupying everybody's like marketing.
That's over with.
Yeah, right.
By the way, if they come to Germany with XCOM, the answer is no, I don't think so. So but anyway, now it's come back and it obviously is back on everyone's radar. And that means that a lot of people probably don't even remember what it's about other than that it, like, oh, it's in Dubai and there's a sandstorm.
Sure. So Spec Ops The Line's third person military themed shooter. But our focus is on this dark and mature narrative of this squad of Delta Force operators going into a very surreal environment, which is Dubai. After it's been hit by cataclysmic sandstorms and rendered a no man's land.
Not just a couple. They keep coming, evidently.
Yeah, they do. There's actually a persistent storm wall around the city, cutting it off from civilization. So our squad goes in without command, basically unleashed from the geopolitical scenarios that are in the region. We have sort of a microcosm to explore some emotional aspects of what happens to them based on some decisions that they make throughout that experience as their squad and their relationship breaks down.
You know, I'm glad this isn't an anime because if it was, it would probably be like aliens that were causing the sandstorm. But that's not part of the plot here.
No, it's not part of the plot. I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but this is a natural disaster. This is something that we feel like it's an interesting thing here in Dubai because the city, basically, if you look at like satellite imagery of the city 10 years ago, it really didn't exist. And so it was built just out of the ambition of man. And you know how nature likes to react to things like that. Hmm. So
that's an interesting element that you don't expect. That's a level of depth you don't expect just off of, you know, shooter with dudes in fatigues.
Well, and a crap ton of money is there. I mean, that's
– yeah, it
you
is.
Know, that's one of the richest, you know, areas around there.
Yeah, that opulence that's there. It's like it was really interesting to us because it allowed us to do, you know, more bright, colorful environments right. With all like the gold and marble and glass and stuff that's there in Dubai. And that amazing architecture for vertical combat was a lot of fun. But, you know, with the sand that's there, you know, you're walking on sand dunes that you maybe think are just standard sand dunes, but they could be covering like an entire skyscraper. You might fall through a glass roof into entombed environments that are just like the day the sandstorms hit. So there's a lot of contrast there in Dubai, and we hit a lot of those landmarks that are there. And we actually structure this narrative going down this path, down this road that's called Sheikh Zayed Road there in Dubai. That's a 16-lane highway with sort of a canyon of skyscrapers on both sides. So that's basically our river into the heart of darkness that we follow throughout the game.
Oh, a little Joseph Conrad.
Yes, definitely.
Nice.
Yeah, and Corey was saying one of his favorite movies is Apocalypse Now. Right?
Yeah, I really like a lot of those movies that came back – that actually came out after Vietnam when a lot of soldiers came back with stories and sort of expressed how they felt about those scenarios. They weren't the most realistic war movies of all time. But at the same time, to me, they were like really emotionally realistic.
So Apocalypse Now is one of my all-time favorite movies.
I once saw a snail crawling across a straight razor.
Just real quick,
man. That's good.
Redux or no Redux?
I like them both, actually. I like some of the scenes in Redux. What are you going to talk to me about, the French scene or something?
No, this is not a film show.
Oh, okay.
So we're not going to do that. I was just hoping that it wasn't Redux completely.
Oh, really?
I'm a little more the purist.
Yeah, I like that as well. But at the same time, like, you know, I go back and watch the documentary about how it was made and everything. And I like to get as much of that as I can. I think it's like it was sort of a very unique experience for all the people making that film. Mm-hmm. And I think it pushed a lot of those guys to their absolute limit. And so even though there's flaws with Redux, I still really appreciate it.
So clearly that's a big narrative influence. And
sure.
We don't want to spoil the story. But if you guys were sitting around, let's say, about three or four years ago talking about what this game is going to be, getting ready to pitch it and come up with the ideas, what were some of the things that you said, hey, there's a lot of third-person shooters out there, obviously. We know we're going to get compared right off the bat. What's going to make us something that isn't just another Unreal Engine shooter with dudes with guns and camo?
Yeah, well, the first words that were spoken about the project were the Heart of Darkness. That was our very initial reference that we started with, Conrad's novella, and the universal themes that are found there. The themes of, you know, what is the soul of man and how is it affected by the decisions that he makes and what happens to him when he has to live with those decisions for the rest of his life. And so we really wanted to humanize the characters in this game, not just the characters that you control, but also the enemies in the game as much as possible. So we sort of went down that path, made a bunch of decisions. And then, like you said, we were at E3 2010, and we got sort of our first public feedback for the game. And we had some scenes, the ones that we showed at E3, that we were really, really happy about. But it also told us the direction that we needed to go in order to be successful with something this ambitious. And 2K gave us the opportunity to go back and actually take a look at our script and some of the focus tests that were happening around that time. Because it wasn't just the public that was seeing that demo. It was also a hell of a lot of focus testing that was going on with some return focus testers that had played early prototypes as well. And we had to really sort of internalize some tough feedback. And that's something that I think as game developers we have to be prepared to do. We have to be ready to fix.
So what were some of those pieces that twisted on you that you guys weren't immediately thinking that's where we wanted to go?
Well, I would say that the thing that was the most tough to sort of swallow for us was that the story had become too complicated. Hmm. We had gotten to the point where a lot of people were not understanding the context behind some of those really important events to us, those emotional sequences, because they weren't understanding how integral the different factions were that were found there in Dubai. Because it's not your standard go in and kill the bad guy type of scenario. There's a lot of different factions there, and you end up in this mistaken identity in a crossfire between some warring factions there in Dubai. And so once we were able to go back and fine-tune that script and actually brought our squad back into the voice studio and really helped them understand the evolution of our characters and also those other factions that are involved with those scenarios, those moments that we really cared about started to rank much, much better with our focus test groups. And so we had to swallow some tough feedback, which is something that, like I said, I think we need to be prepared to do, especially if we're going to try and step out into a new area with storytelling, for example. And especially when you're hitting on these universally controversial themes that can be just seen as shock value if you just throw them in there and they don't have that important context behind them.
So. I think a lot of people hear the phrase focus testing and they probably hear it as a bad word. You know, it gets a really bad connotation to a lot of people. Like, oh, you know, playing to the lowest common denominator or whatever. It's interesting to me that you think of it as such a positive influence on your design process. Can you talk a little bit more about, the kinds of people that you get for focus testing, how you internalize that kind of feedback and
yeah.
And
well, like I don't think you can really label focus testing as any one thing because like focus testing is all about the interpretation that you have of the feedback that you get and how you deal with that feedback. Mm. If we were to go in and just take for face value everything that every focus tester said and not try and dig deeper into the reasons why they said those things
yeah.
or the reasons why they felt those things, then we would be designing for the lowest common denominator. It would be just, you know, this sort of committee of ideas filtering down into something that's probably not very interesting.
Right.
And so basically we have a lot of data tracking and different tools that we use in order to be able to tell like, oh, so that guy, he said this thing about this scene. Well, actually I can go back and I can pull up his play session and I can look at where he went, what he did, what he looked at, the things he interacted with, where he fired his weapon, what gear he chose.
That's so interesting.
And so you start to end up with and as you do this continuously and you sort of fine-tune those tools, you start to learn some lessons about how you can how you can take feedback and push it into the right direction so that you make good decisions along the way.
Well, probably a little bit about player psychology too.
Definitely.
I mean, that's crazy if you can see that level of detail about what they're interacting with, where they're doing stuff. Where, you know,
yeah, it's really surprising. Awesome. Like if you – because I early in my career I was at studios that, you know, testing multiplayer stuff where you're just basically trying to find out what the problems were.
Right.
And this isn't anything like that. You're trying to figure out why something wasn't emotionally impactful to mm-hmm. someone. And, you know, or maybe why their expectations weren't fulfilled. And yeah, so we have to have a lot of guys that are really critical on the team and are willing to say, I thought that was going to be this way, but it actually is this way. And yeah. I'm able to say, okay, I'm changing my mind as a developer, and we're gonna make that change in the game.
I'm going to be honest with you. We're 10 minutes into talking about this game, and we haven't talked about gun handling, weaponization, character building, any of that kind of stuff. So I think that – I mean, I applaud you for being risky. I think it's really risky to be so narrative focused. I think it's cool. I think it's interesting. I think that it's a really difficult battle right now. I mean, this is something that I've talked to the folks over at Treyarch about as well, because, you know, right now, especially because the influence of Call of Duty is so strong, there's the impression that storytelling in first-person shooters, especially military ones, is a joke.
Sure.
It's like it's pretty much a joke. You're going to run out and do a summer blockbuster at best. There's going to be a bunch of silly over-the-top crap, and it's all just a veneer in order to, you know, put a M16 in your hand and give you a bunch of targets of opportunity and have a fun time running through a shooting gallery. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Sure.
Keep in mind, I actually enjoy that. I mean, that's kind of fun at times. So how do you overcome – I mean, how do you guys get to the point where you overcome that? And I think maybe – there's multiple ways, so maybe like break it down into like something about some about, you know, on the ground level design and some about high levels. One of the things I noticed in the first act is that I think there's a very conscientious decision that you guys have done, at least in that level,
conscious decision.
Yeah. Yes, right, not conscientious. Although it could have been conscientious. Conscious decision. It's someone on Gaff pointed out I'd make that mistake all the time, so obviously it's in my head. A conscious decision to keep the scale of the action environments very up close and personal.
Sure.
And while you show a lot of skyscapes and you show a lot of, you know, vistas, there's a lot of times where things are moving from, you know, space to space is very close, very personal. You're starting to work those relationships right off the bat. So, I mean, maybe that's part of it, but I think that it's still a challenge because here we are that – you know, in the big scale of things, a giant set of sandstorms that hold a wall around Dubai is almost on – I mean, that is not even almost – I mean, that's also on the, like, crazy, you know, fantasy end of the world sort of stuff as well.
Sure.
So how do you guys hold on to that and still keep it, you know, serious for this darkness?
Yeah, well, I think as gamers, we've matured, and as game developers, we want to mature as well. We want things that are challenging to us. We want to talk about themes that are important to us. And the only way to do that is to really dive in deep into those things that we care about and find out ways to implement them in the game. And I honestly don't want to act like we're trying to come out and be like a Call of Duty killer or something like that. I think that those games, they're great. They need to exist. But our decisions that we made up front were quite a lot different than theirs. Like, for example, we stay with our characters and our perspective the entire time throughout the game. We don't ever jump forward in timelines. We don't ever see anyone else's perspective on what our characters are doing. That's something we really wanted you to build that intimate relationship with them so that when those important plot points happen later on, they're meaningful to you as a player. And I think a lot of times the action outweighs the narration in these games. And it's that way almost always, and that's intentional. And I think that's great for what they're doing. But we don't need to do what they're doing. They've done it, you know, 7-8 iterations now successfully. And so trying to just jump into that mix, I think, would be a big mistake. But, you know, those are great games. And what we're doing is basically taking this journey that these characters are on, attaching you to this squad, and then basically starting out like you had mentioned. I can tell you've played the beginning of the game. As you get further into that campaign, you're going to see these relationships break down in a way that you're not going to see in those other types of games that we're talking about. And so I think that that's pretty cool, and I'm glad that we had the opportunity to do it. And it's fucking risky. It is.
It is.
And you know, we found that out the hard way. Honestly, we found that out by, you know, going into focus testing and finding out that a lot of these things that we had hoped weren't triggering the way that we'd liked. And so we had the opportunity to go back and try and hit those things harder.
Because, like, you know, like Homeland tried
Homefront.
Homefront. So you guys boned up on that some, I guess.
We definitely followed Homefront, definitely. Yeah, that was an interesting thing. I have a lot of friends that worked on it.
And it was cool. It almost felt like at first it was going to go somewhere, and then the more you played into it, it sort of slowly just became a run, shoot, move. I'm in the same thing.
Well, I think it was, pretty successful on a certain level of raising issues and making you feel uncomfortable and making you think.
It certainly
a
made you
bit.
Feel uncomfortable.
Yeah,
there were certainly places where it made you feel uncomfortable.
The thing about Homefront, and you know, talking to developers that worked on it, it was a multiplayer focused game.
It was,
yeah.
And that's
that crew's forte.
Sure, and there's nothing wrong with that, but for some reason it wasn't portrayed that way. And so when people picked up that game, they didn't expect that. You have to remember that development team came out of a mod team that was a Battlefield 1942 mod team.
Right.
Chaos.
And, yeah.
Yeah, they're awesome.
And they did was it Desert Combat, and that was a fantastic mod, and that's really what they wanted to do. And they did
Frontlines?
Yeah, they did Frontlines,
which was very underrated.
Yeah.
But the idea of that game, I think, was bigger than that. I think that the concept really struck a nerve with people.
Sure.
And the imagery that they were showing, I think, was a double-edged sword, because I certainly latched onto that and was like, oh, my God. And then talking about having what's his name?
The Red Dawn guy.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. It's fine.
Anyway, I should know. Anyway, having him involved and I mean, really making it feel like Red Dawn the game in a lot of ways, and this what if the what if was so tantalizing that I think it was
definitely interesting, and I'm sure if they had the chance, they would love to go back and sort of fine tune some of those things. Mm-hmm. But you know, they made a great multiplayer game that no one played.
Yeah,
and that's too bad, because when it came out, you know, Battlefield wasn't out yet on the Xbox, and if you played the demo, even it's really addictive and it's really cool. And so it's a bit of a shame that it wasn't brought out, you know, as strong on the multiplayer front as it was on the single player front. And I think that they definitely felt some pain for that. And we did the exact opposite. Our multiplayer was driven out of our single player.
Yeah.
And so our focus from the very beginning was single player. And if there was ever going to be – I mean, if there was ever going to be a conversation about compromises, it wasn't going to be about our single player.
Yeah. It's interesting. I feel like the messaging coming out of Spec Ops, and maybe even the title itself, doesn't do justice to what you're kind of talking about, because I'm so much more interested – to play through the campaign, hearing your discussion of it,
sure,
than I have been.
But
let's play the
game then of trying to market that. How do you, in a world where where Call of Duty is the reigning king of militaristic shooters, with a great online presence that seems to be driving it day in and day out, seeing the millions of people who are on Elite? I mean, obviously that's driven, you know, the Battlefield Close Quarters update that has driven them to do Battlefield Premium. How do you then come along with something that, on the face of it, when you have 30 seconds in a television ad or something captured attention to show somebody a guy with a gun in a shooting situation, not try to sell to that and say, you know what I really want you to do is I want you to imagine the emotions this guy is going through as he's going into this ruined city to try and find this colonel who is off on a, we think, humanitarian mission
trying to
save a bunch of people, but we don't really know what he's up to.
But we're giving it short shrift too, because I think it does have a striking visual look. I mean, it really does. It doesn't look like it looks like an Unreal game, but it doesn't look like any other Unreal game. It doesn't that Dubai setting and the way you guys have realized that sandstorm look, I found it to be very striking. I mean, just walking by it at E3, I was like, oh wow, there's Spec Ops. Oh, I want to get my hands on that.
It was wonderful working with that environment as well. Like, I if I don't have the chance to work in that environment again, I'm definitely going to miss it. It was like,
really?
Yeah, because, you know, basically when we'd go into developing an interior space, for example, we'd first off start with our reference images, and then we'd go, you know, how do we Dubaiify this thing, which basically means make it like the coolest fucking thing you can possibly imagine.
Because everything's sci-fi and futuristic.
Yeah. This plus $500 billion.
And, yeah, and so like – and then, you know, the way weapons react in those types of environments is very, very cool as well, and the lighting scenarios that you can end up with light filtering through sand-covered windows into crystal chandeliers that's, you know, filtering down into like a glass and marble peacock, for example. Like, it's all those things are just – really cool, and they add a lot of contrast to the gunfire that's happening in those entombed spaces.
I think something that just came up there that I wanted to explore, we talked about this earlier, is the you guys are on Unreal Engine.
Sure.
And there's like all kinds of iterations. We won't worry about which exact one you're on, but you're on Unreal Engine. And like happened with Dishonored, when the Unreal logo popped up, I said, we're finally getting away from that Unreal look. And it's a conversation I had with the guys at Arkane, and they talked a lot about art design and how much by putting effort into that now, they're really able to bring – to tame the Unreal Engine and get it to do what they want it to do more so than ever before. And I think you guys have gotten into that. What were some of the key pieces that you wanted to convey from a creative art approach to make the Dubaiification, as you put it, really work? And why does it not look like an Unreal Engine game finally?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the games that develop on Unreal, they use reference from other Unreal games. I mean, like, how did they make that thing look cool? Well, I'm using the same technology. I can do that. That's not risky. That's something that I can do. And so a lot of times, like, you may have inconsistencies in your art and things like that. Throwing desaturation over those things really just sort of add some free consistency. And that's not something that...
For folks who are listening, explain desaturation.
So basically just taking the color palette down to something that's not as vibrant allows you to mask some of the flaws in your artwork in the game. But also there's ways around that. That to me is a crutch that shouldn't be used, I'll be honest. From the start, we wanted to get away from that. But also the fact that we're releasing when we are, the Unreal Engine has really changed a lot as well.
Okay.
There's some new lighting techniques that are there that are really amazing. But at the same time, I don't want to act like it was all just the sort of conceptual side of this. We have a really strong tech team at Jaeger. Our tech lead, Hendrik Hunica, and Florian Zonder, our effects lead, and Ken Mayfield, these guys that build our sand avalanches and things like that. And the whole team sort of just jumped in together to try and make this happen. And we never allowed ourselves to just be a brown shooter. But there's also a lot of other little techniques as well. You may have noticed that like this texture streaming is a little bit stronger than what you're used to, meaning that when you walk up to a wall, you're not going to see it pop with that detail coming in late. There's a lot of difficult decisions you have to make along the way. You're not going to see a lot of aliasing in the game because we made sure that the types of objects that we build don't have frivolous edges and tiny little pieces on them that really sort of fuck up the renderer.
So you went down to the effort of the furnishings of levels doing edge analysis.
Definitely. Everywhere we went, if there's a rope hanging in the environment, it needs to be a certain thickness if you're going to see it from a certain distance, or it just looks like a jaggedy edge shitty thing. And so we had a lot of people on the team that were just like willing to go in there with a fine-tooth comb and be like, we're going to adjust this and this and this and this and this and this and really not allow ourselves to compromise. And so the tech team really came together with the conceptual and art team on that and both had the same goal to make that happen. Then you got Dubai that just, there's reflections everywhere. There's, brightly colored glass. There's marble and gold. And like I've said a couple of times, that city just is not a brown desert city at all. It doesn't look like a Middle Eastern city. It's as beautiful and vibrant as anything you're going to find on the planet. And then, that really beautiful coastline that they have there as well really helps a lot too. And so, and then the sand element that's there, like it would be easy to just, sort of damage all of those assets that are there to the point where you can desaturate them, like I mentioned, which, if you run out of time when you're developing a game, that's what you do. You just throw that
on there
and get it out the door.
Okay.
And so we were able to plan ahead and make sure that that wasn't the case because, like you've been mentioning, this is not an easy genre to jump into.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and we knew that coming into it. And I feel really lucky that we had the chance to take some risks with that stuff.
So how did that then play into the decision that, at least from what I played through in the first act, felt like you guys, instead of trying to reinvent the combat system, just said, you know what, people have played Gears. They know how the Gears combat system works. They know how roadie run works. They know how hopping into cover works. They know what the button layout is here. They know how there's a certain vocabulary even within event areas and I'm calling event areas like places you're going to have a firefight inside the level, that we're going to do some of those things that when they get to that part of the game are going to be the same. What was, like, how did you get to that decision, and what kind of concerns did you have about people saying, Well, I've done this. It's Gears, but with dudes.
Yeah, I mean, that's really tough because basically what we did from the start, like I mentioned, was we put our narrative in the driver's seat. So we didn't want a lot of things distracting you from that. There's always this discussion, especially there was a number of guys on the team that came from sort of they're gamers that play tactical shooters. And so really wanted to infuse a lot more tactics into the squad commands, for example.
Which you guys do have some squad
commands.
We do.
We do have squad commands. But for us, these are a narrative tool before they're a gameplay tool. And so we had to constantly evaluate our decisions as we were moving forward about whether or not things that we did would become distracting or that we would overload the player with information. And so we wanted you to get through that learning curve very, very quickly. And then we sort of do some interesting things that are very particular to our environment. Like, for example, our lean over system that allows you to do verticality in ways that you're not going to find in other third-person shooters.
I'm going to get you to explain that a little bit because vertical combat is certainly a buzzword in the last year or so.
Sure.
So how do you mean?
So what I mean is that in this game, you can actually lean over a cover object seamlessly from your typical aiming position, much further angle, much deeper angle, and be able to target enemies seamlessly below you or above you without any camera pops or anything like that. So that was something that I was
like
really...
Like over a railing or something.
Yes, over a railing. And we also created a cover system that allows you to pretty fluently move between really dense cover objects. You notice a lot of cover-based games have really large rooms with blocks. And that's not Dubai at all. You're going to find that maybe in an office or something like that. But in Dubai, basically, you've got pillars everywhere. You've got art pieces. You've got, you know, sports cars instead of, you know, your standard vans that you're taking cover behind and things like that. And so a lot of our decisions on gameplay is, like with everything that we did, drove out of the narrative and the space that we were building it in, which was Dubai. That's what really inspired us to develop our mechanics. And we, like I said, we didn't want to push anything into the game just because we wanted it there. It needed to really feel like it fit and it made sense in that environment. Yeah, and so basically, we wanted to make sure that nothing in Spec Ops Line was detracting you from that narrative experience.
So we haven't even touched on AI, and I kind of wanted to let Corey have a chance to kind of wrap up like we do when we do these things of like, hey, you guys designed this thing forever. What are some of the things that you don't think people will see that you'd kind of like to tip them to if they go to play the game? So why don't we take a little breather? We'll come back and wrap up with that, and then we'll segue right into letting him talk about Lollipop Chainsaw because that's what he's been playing. I love the juxtaposition of cheerleaders with decapitated.
Narrative is the most important thing for me. So I've been playing Lollipop Chainsaw.
And it's this chick with her boyfriend's decapitated head so that he doesn't die from zombification.
Man, are you bummed out that they made pretty much exactly the same game you guys were making?
I know, right?
Similar. I was like, why did they have to release earlier than us?
That's actually what happens.
All right, so we'll come back. We'll talk about AI. We'll wrap things up on Spec Ops The Line, and we'll get into some other stuff. Don't go anywhere. We have the second half of We Can Confirm coming right up. Week in Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from shacknews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 8,000 games. New version 2.0 for the iPhone and iPod Touch includes cool new features like social interaction. Now you can follow and interact with the crew from Week in Confirmed in the Gamefly app. Check out what Jeff Cannata, Del Rio, and I are playing and saying about the latest games. And as always, the app is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices. All right, coming back to wrap up a little bit on Spec Ops The Line. But something really interesting that Corey Davis and I were talking about, he is the lead designer from Jaeger in Germany, where they do speak English.
Yes, they do.
It's pretty funny. There's a whole other side conversation we won't get distracted into. Anyway, we were talking about ballistics modeling and how because they hadn't gone down the avenue of making combat a distraction and how quickly if I get focus on the weapon they were worried about, you know, then getting distracted again, of course, because I was saying, you know, look, when I play Call of Duty, I worry about like which rifle I'm carrying, which holographic sight I have, whether I have a holographic or an ACOG, you know, all these different pieces, which then it's all into weaponization. And then what he pointed out was, you know, if you really did the weapons ballistic modeling, like realistic, like people want, say they want, it would really make people angry. Tell them what you were telling me because I thought it was a good, interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, we obviously did a lot of research on weaponry, and we had a military advisor, a former special forces guy that we were shooting weapons with in the desert and things like that. But basically, like the range and the accuracy of these weapons is much different than the way it's typically portrayed in games. And so, you know, a lot of people when they pick up an SMG, they want to be able to only use that at short range and things like that. And that's important to game design because you want to have a lot of variety in the types of things that you're able to to do and feel like you have a real toolbox. But if those things were entirely realistic, basically, you know, the delta between one assault rifle versus another, or one assault rifle even versus an SMG, is not as much as what gamers expect.
Huh.
And so, like, an SMG, for example, is extremely effective at what we consider in games to be long range.
Interesting.
And so if you go down that path of pure realism, that can be really dangerous. I mean, there's gamers out there that want that, but that's definitely not the path that we went down. We wanted to really express sort of the power and brutality of modern weaponry, put it in your hands, and show you what it does to people.
Yeah.
And so, like you'd mentioned before, we wanted to pull the combat as up close and personal as we could. We definitely wanted to add a lot of variety between the different weapon classes so that you can think about what you're using, and they do what you'd expect. And also, like you said, we didn't want to have like a whole massive weapon customization thing in the game or anything like that, because this game is about our characters. It's not about our weapons. And those weapons are there as tools, because they're what we're doing destruction with in the game. But it's the way that it affects and sort of feeds back to the main characters that's important to us.
So with the idea that narrative and story and all those things are very important, one of the key pieces of maintaining the illusion is artificial intelligence, both
sure.
in your squad mates and in the enemies. And it's one of the pieces of really, really rapidly evolving game design. It's one of the places we still have a long way to go.
Definitely.
What were you guys doing with yours? How does it work? And what do you think were some successes of it? And where are you like hoping you can get to in the future?
So, you know, AI is it's a little bit about technology and calculation. It's a lot about perception. And it's a lot about, you know, having things happen in the right place at the right time and an illusion that you create. You know, coming off of games like that I worked on in the past, like Fear and Condemned, a lot of people, you hear them say like, oh, well, those are really smart AI. No, they're not smart at all. they know we basically built systems that allow them to appear smart in the right situations. And in Spec Ops The Line, we sort of have a mix between you know, these really high action sequences where we want all of the characters that are there to be in the right spot at the right time versus some sort of sandboxy open areas, no pun intended. So the parts that are really interesting to me, though, as a game designer, are when the AI get to roam freely and make their own decisions. And we have a lot of different classes of AI. And so we actually empowered our designers on our team to be able to use the sort of what we call them behavior trees that allow you to very specifically change the way different classes of AI behave. And so you're going to see at the start of the game, you know, armed refugees that they're more brutal than they are tactical. And so they may charge you, for example. They may do things that you don't expect. They may do things that you would say a soldier wouldn't do that. And we did that intentionally. Then later on in the game, you're actually going to meet American soldiers, and you're going to meet some different factions there, that like the Damn 33rd that's there, Conrad's battalion, and then some people that actually went rogue from his battalion. Then you're going to find other factions there as well. And each of those basically has their own behavior tree in the way that they work. So you should, if you pay attention, you're going to notice a lot of difference in the way that they move around the environment, the way that they coordinate with each other, the way that they flank or they don't, and then also the weaponry and you know, the standard stuff that's typically done to ramp up the difficulty of AI with the weaponry and the armor that they have and things like that. But we have like elite soldiers that come in later on that behave almost entirely differently than those refugees you're going to meet at the start of the game.
Is it dynamic enough that if I go back and play it again, I'll get different experiences? Because I think one of the things that has become disappointing to fans of Call of Duty who feel like Call of Duty has sort of abandoned them was that even through 2 and maybe a little bit past it, but not a lot past there, there was still this sense that if I go and play the game, I get like different responses. Certainly is one of the things people loved about Halo.
Sure.
Was that sense of a dynamic battle. Like think about that first scene in Halo. You're coming down and you're on the planet. And I'm thinking about first scene, like when you're coming across the bridge, you're about to encounter the Covenant, you see the drop ship. And if you replayed that level over and over and over, you'd see the drop ship land and you'd see the grunts and the brutes hop off of it. And then that would be it. Like, then the game would start and different things would happen almost every time.
You know, I'm a total freak for that stuff. Like, I remember in Halo specifically, before you even get down on the planet, before shit hits the fan, you have a pistol in your hand. I remember going around and trying – I would kill someone on that ship that was an ally to me, because then they would spawn in these troops that would come in and try and take you out. And they were fully unscripted.
Really?
Yes, unscripted. Go back and check it out. And you can try and survive there as long as you can. Eventually, they'll kill you. But you can really sort of push the boundaries of what they could do with their AI. And, you know, Fear was the same way for me. When I go back and play Fear, there's some scripted moments in there. But at the same time, like, those guys really move around differently every time I play. Spec Ops: The Line, there are some scripted moments in there. I'm not going to lie to you. We had to have some events take place the way that in a controlled environment.
That's the challenge of a narrative droid.
Definitely. But, like, I sort of put myself to the test last week, because I, you know, once we went into submission, I was hands off the game as I came over here to the U.S. And so I had a chance to go back and
play. Sounds like you went into submission, isn't it?
Yeah. I did. Basically, they said, you know, you don't get to touch it any longer.
Like, I submit.
And but then, you know, going back just today, for example, and playing, I'm still really enjoying it. I'm seeing things that I didn't see before, that I didn't expect. And I know generally where they're getting spawned in, how they're getting spawned in and things like that, what logic we're using at each moment. But it's still really exciting, especially when those other factions come in that have different behavior and they sort of mix together.
Good.
It gets really interesting.
Good. All right. So as you wrap this thing up now, and you have a chance to go back and play it a couple times, sure. What do you think are some of the things that people who go out and get Spec Ops: The Line are going to maybe breeze past or not notice, or that you'd like to call their attention to, like, to, you know, hey, this part was cool, guys?
Yeah. The thing that sticks out to me the most that's very subtle, especially at the start of the game, is the element of the surreal that's here in Spec Ops: The Line. So like I'd said a couple of times earlier, we're not just trying to put you into the shoes of the soldier, we're trying to put you in the mind of the soldier. And a very particular soldier who's gone through some very difficult and trying scenarios and has had to sort of hold the weight of his decisions on his shoulders for his squad and try and hold himself together. So the surreal begins to bleed into the gameplay experience very early on. And if you pay close attention and even replay, you're going to start to notice how some things connect that you didn't expect before. And so I expect a pretty healthy debate about the narrative and where it's headed once we've released the game. There's some twists and turns in there and some really sort of dark ways that we've connected some events together that I hope people pay attention to. And some of those decisions that you make, they don't have necessarily a very immediate, like, tangible reward coming out of them. But if you pay attention to the way the characters react and also the environment around you, it's really telling a story and reacting to the decisions that you've made as a player. And so, like, we had the opportunity to invest in some of that, and that to me is like the coolest thing in the world. I come out of those horror games where you're really like,
what did I say? Is Alma going to show up here at some moment? Not exactly the same, but
yeah. I mean, I don't want to spoil.
No, I know
it
you're
for
being
you,
you're being intentionally cryptic, and that's cool.
Yeah,
all right.
But basically,
so pay attention to your surroundings.
Yeah, pay attention to your surroundings and look for environmental storytelling that's going to help you connect some dots in ways that you probably don't expect.
That's pretty cool. Do you think I'll come back to multiplayer at all? Because since that wasn't, you know, like your initial focus, but obviously it's something that's in there. It's like got, you know, some potential to be picked
sure.
up, especially because I'm still a believer that if you have a good single player game, people want to play more of it, then multiplayer works.
Definitely. And that's the way we drove this thing. We had a dedicated team on multiplayer. It was important to us that we weren't sort of bleeding resources into multiplayer or making compromises along the way, that those guys were able to focus entirely on that. But like, you're going to see all the sand elements in multiplayer. You're going to see that vertical architecture of Dubai. You're going to be able to fight in those sandstorms and sort of run across enemy lines when they're disoriented and things like that. It's a more intimate multiplayer experience than what you're going to see in a lot of the other military shooters that are out there, because it's a 4-on-4. It's all about coordination and communication with your squad and your loadouts and your perks and things like that. I mean, I'm excited to play it. I hope people are as well. I think that inherently the fact that we, you know, focused on really tight game mechanics rather than, you know, tons of crazy new ones makes for a really great multiplayer experience.
Hmm. All right. So, you know, Seth already told me that when he comes next week, he wants to talk about Spec Ops.
Oh, good.
So, Corey, I don't know whether to tell you to listen next week or to not listen. You know, because the detector will be on and
sure.
either the detection will be reading one way or the other next week. So, folks, when you awesome. Come back next week,
Well, I'm going to have to play through it by then. So
yeah, the Spec Ops conversation will be, wow, that Corey guy was amazing. Did you see all that? And then it'll be like, really? Like he like threw us under the bus. We didn't even know.
Corey's full of shit.
Oh, my God. Can you believe that guy? Which is why he was playing Lollipop Chainsaw.
Yes,
which is why I would let him like explain how you got – how do you come out of Spec Ops: The Line and decide, you know what I want to play?
It seems to make a lot of sense, actually. It's like, I want to get as far away from what we've been –
polar opposite, please.
Yeah,
I want to play cheerleader with her disembodied head of the boyfriend.
Yeah, I mean it's a much lighter experience.
Are you a Suda fan?
Yeah, I definitely am aware of his crazy sense of humor and the way he's, you know, parodying a lot of things and you know, sort of subverting our expectations when it comes to different themes. And I think that's really exciting. He's doing it in a lot different way than we are. But it's really a lot of fun. It's really joyful. It's really beautiful. It's really brutal. And those things are great to me.
It is a gorgeous game. And it's and just because of how many disparate art styles he blends together. So I played last night. I played the prologue and the first chapter.
Okay.
And it is like, okay, so you know Suda. Like I just – the one thing that I wish is that
– Wait, first of all, does the core mechanic work? Because sometimes Suda has this problem like Killer 7 where it just sort of like falls apart in your hands.
Here's the thing. There's a lot of different little distractions in the game, even in the first two chapters, like a bunch of different things you're doing and different power-ups and stuff, and you get a suite of moves that you're unlocking. But it suffers from the same thing that other Suda 51 – I see. I love his style. I love his like, you know – equal parts, you know, OMG, what WTF and freaking like LOL, like all kind of like blended together. That's like his design motif. But mechanically.
You forgot BBQ.
And BBQ.
Did you say BBW?
And, no, I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think that actually is in the game.
Every so often.
Yeah, it might be.
Every so often you ill-advisedly throw one of those in there and you're like, wait, did I just do that?
Oops.
So anyway, I guess the point that I was trying to make is Suda 51's or his game's mechanics, while they're serviceable and especially the ones that are just mini distractions can be fun, they're not quite as evolved and meaty and they're a little chunky. So I don't know. It's very – the combat in it reminded me a lot of No More Heroes. Now, I never played it on a controller. No More Heroes. I was always waggle and stuff, but it's got that sort of like, you know, you're chopping up a bunch of zombies and then you look at the screen, you're like, what the fuck is going on right now? And well, I mean, you know, you're chopping zombies up, but like there's crazy little cutaways to like, you know, you kill three zombies at once and you get this whole sparkle background and these like crazy coins and shit. It's like, I like it because it's really super entertaining to experience.
Right.
But to play it is, you have to admit, it's not Bayonetta combat. You know,
Definitely not.
It's not like, it doesn't have that fluidity of frames moving into frames and everything kind of blending together. It's, you know, you use your power attack with your chainsaw and it's, it's very, very deliberate, like slow attacks and it sort of, it doesn't have like that free flowing.
The way you're describing it physically, which people can't see, I'm assuming what you mean is that you really are aware of the animation cycles as they process.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's not cool. That's well,
no, well,
it's
like
a thing.
You got to be forgiving of this thing as well, though, because like it's literally a game where you can tell a few dudes got together and were like, "What's the coolest fucking thing we can do right now in this environment? What's the craziest thing we can possibly imagine?" And they just did it. There was there was no one in there being like, "Oh, that's too far," you know, or like, "I think we should pull back a little bit on that." And they were like, "No, fuck that. We want to have, you know, just the craziest, most."
All right, what's the craziest thing you saw that you like so far?
Well, you mentioned like, honestly, I'm not too far into the game. I'm just like a half hour into it, but I'm definitely hooked. Was when my boyfriend gets his, you know, gets bit by a zombie. And I cut his head off with a chainsaw and then loop his head around my belt. And then I can grab a ticket so that I can put his head on another zombie and then do a pom-pom cheerleader dance to control him into killing other dudes for me.
Yeah. Oh, that mechanic again?
Yeah, again. And granted, you look at it and mechanically, it's a QTE.
Sure.
But the concept is like you're watching it and you can't help but laugh. I mean the whole segment of right after she cuts the guy's head off And he's like a sentient head who's like, why the fuck do I have no body? And he's like freaking out. And it's the one of the – I was literally laughing out loud when I was playing this thing.
Yeah, and he's like screaming and shit. And he's like attached to your ass.
He's like, oh my God, what the fuck?
Oh my God.
Another thing. Everyone who plays this game is going to try and look up that girl's skirt. I don't care who you are. Fair. They have fully supported this. Like she has she has animations where she'll go to like cover up no matter which angle you look at her from. And I got an achievement for doing that right away.
I like that they're aware.
See, there
of
is
the
achievements for emotions.
Yeah, there you go.
Pantsu unlocked.
I think the achievement was like it wasn't on purpose or something like that. Like,
it wasn't on purpose. Of course. I was just rotating the camera. Your camera's broken anyway. It always is. Everyone knows like, that about your games.
Like John Candy from Splash. The coins, you know. Oh, I'm the only one that watched Splash in the 80s. Okay.
Oh, Splash was
just
a good movie.
You, man. All just right. You. Just you.
Wait. I don't know. John Candy? Oh, yeah. He was the
brother that drops the coins and always uses it to look at the.
Yeah.
The,
yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Is that like putting a mirror on your shoe or something?
I wouldn't know.
Oh, okay.
Anywho, so that's in the game.
So, well, but this, that's a great example, though. As uncomfortable as that little moment was, it's like there's plenty of that shit in there, too. Like, like jaw dropping, like no, they didn't just do that. Yeah, they did, and they're doing it like times 10, like a second later, and you're just like.
So,
okay.
For as much as we're laughing and having fun talking about this, like, what is the deal with
What's the deal
with what is our thought in light of, you know, positive responses to games like this as to why they're not successful, why Japanese gaming has been in such decline? I mean, I don't know if you saw this or not. But, you know, the head of Team Ninja talked to Gamasutra some about Ninja Gaiden 3 and how they lost focus. And, I mean, a bit of it was, you know, the classic falling on his sword sort of thing and protecting the team and saying, you know, I lost focus and we did these things. But here's the thing that's interesting is he said at one point, I think we tried to make a Japanese hamburger for the West when what we should have made was great Japanese food. So do we want great Japanese food? I'm confused. Like we say that this is fun and hilarious, but then it doesn't work. But then they try and go Western and that doesn't work. I'm a big supporter of this sort of style. I love it.
Dude, you don't want to try German-Mexican food. Just trust me on that. Fully support his argument. Like Germans should make awesome German food. It's just the way it is.
So in other words, don't have the empanadas in Cologne this August.
No, get a schnitzel and just shut the fuck up.
So anyway, do you guys have any additional thought about that? I mean, his thing was that, you know, I think that he got to the right point because the point he closed on was that a great Japanese game has to have a very immediate, tactile, super fast response on screen. And that is something we grew to associate with him. We grew to associate, you know, games from Japan with action, ninja, fighting, adventure, but adventure games that were very focused on combos and melee combat. And the further they drift away from that, the more they sort of lose pace.
I think in the case of Ninja Gaiden 3, I think it's probably at least as much as that it's an established series that has a pedigree and has, you know, people have expectations going into that about what they want. And they don't want like shitloads of cutscenes and like the kind of stuff that they were doing with the new version. So like, some of the problems that.
For me, like why are you developing your game? Are you developing your game because the market's telling you that you should? Or are you developing your game because it's what you're inspired to do? And I think that that's when developers fall into a pitfall is when they try to make their game for everybody and they lose their inspiration. They lose their focus. And so I really think that there's a place for Japanese games. I think there's a place for extremely difficult, challenging games. And there's also a place for the exact opposite.
Hmm. Well, so certainly that argument about broad spectrum there leads right into Cliff's comments. So I don't know if you were teeing that up for me or not, but but Cliff had an interview with – I want to make sure I credit the site who did the interview so that they get properly credited here. I have it in my notes with Xbox360Achievements.com. And he'd been talking to them. He was lamenting that games have become easier and more linear this generation to attract those broader audiences, and he's starting to get turned off by them. And I immediately thought, really? Because you've been making those games like that for the last 5 years, Cliff. So it's nice you had this epiphany. And I'm not trying to be super silly. I mean, honestly, Gears of War is a linear game that has a lot of QuickTime like event sort of things in it that has been progressively gotten easier and easier in the big scheme of things. I mean, you could certainly on normal, if you're an accomplished gamer, probably get through it without dying. I mean, there's really not a whole lot of places you're going to get wiped out. To where he now says that he's been inspired by how much people love Dark Souls, that that's the kind of challenge he wants. And that in Gears of War Judgment, which is their upcoming Gears of War game, quote, casual mode will still be casual, whatever, if you just want to see graphics and you don't want to die. But every other mode will be hard in this game and you will die. So I guess we're going knee-jerk reaction the other direction because I don't know about this, like, you will die thing.
Yeah, that's
haven't
not...
we learned some things? Like it's one thing to say I want to make it more difficult, but then just to throw out everything we've learned in the past 5 years also seems kind of silly, which is that dying really isn't that fun.
Well, and Demon's Souls isn't great because you die a shitload. It's great because exactly. It's challenging and you're learning and you're getting better at the mechanics and you're, you know, it's all the stuff that you get better at and you feel rewarded for that reason. It's not because, you know, I'm going to fire up a game. I mean, that's – I don't play Super Meat Boy. Well, maybe I play Super Meat Boy for that. But
I would say Super Meat Boy is definitely in there, and Dishwasher Samurai, and
well, I mean, but Super Meat Boy even called that out with their instant replay thing. You finish a level, you see all your deaths leading up to that moment. Like they turned it into a reward mechanic, but the reward is not like, oh, I fell into that saw, now I'm going to fall into this saw, and you know, it's the you know, I'm getting better at this game. I'm leveling up. I'm getting more powerful. I'm, you know, learning. I'm exploring new areas.
Yeah, the death part of it's only like one small aspect of that. And if you're dying and you don't have a tool set to be able to deal – and you're dying because you can't deal with the scenarios that are there inherently because of what's been offered to you as a gamer, that's not cool. I really don't think it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the things that we struggled so hard to overcome even is that – like dying is not really fun. I mean, one of the things that Prey did really well was it overcame that by making dying into a mini game that you escaped death by getting your way back out of the spirit realm. Okay, granted, not every game has Native American fiction that they can draw on to do that sort of foo, but like when you guys were looking at this in the line, how did you think about how are we going to handle health system and player death? Because that's obviously important in a narrative driven game. You don't want to lose people. I mean,
but at the same time, you got to have tension. You got to have danger. You got to have that feeling that you're actually vulnerable to the things that are happening. That sort of attaches you to that experience. But if we didn't provide, you know, opportunities for you to be successful in that environment, I think that would be a cop out. As well as, you know, having AI that do things not because it's difficult, but because they're smart enough to make tactical decisions and, you know, try to outsmart you. I think that's much different than just, you know, having sections that are set up specifically to fuck you.
Yeah, and that right there was the biggest concern I had about what Cliff said here is that you will die. Makes me immediately in a shooter sense think, oh, you're going to set up situations that I come into that I don't know what I'm supposed to do that you're going to kill me in because that made the game harder because now I died and I had to come back some. So I'm getting extended play time out of it and it feels like it's more difficult. Like, for instance, to use the Ninja Gaiden example, Ninja Gaiden was great, especially one because it landed right on the razor's edge of just about the time you were – and I think a lot of people have this experience. Just about the time where you were like, you know what? I am fed up with this game killing me. You learned just enough about how to tactically play it and just enough of the combo system to realize, wait, you know what? If I start doing moves out of this move list and using them in the right places in the right ways, this game isn't actually all that hard because then I can start using it and playing it the right way. But keep in mind what I'm talking about here. Now I'm talking about a game that's a melee game with a lot of different setups. And fundamentally, that's really difficult to replicate when my weapon is a projectile-firing gun in my hand. I don't know how I do that.
And your enemy's not always on screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that you'll die more is the wrong lesson to learn. And maybe he's just being inarticulate about expressing the lesson he learned from that. But I think that what is exciting to Dark Souls players and even me who's not a Dark Souls player per se but appreciates it from afar is that the game forces you to think. It forces you to assess a situation on a different level than you normally do in games that are similar to that. And it forces you to to handle the game mechanics in a way that you haven't really done in a role-playing game before. And if that's what he's trying to accomplish in the third-person shooter setting to go, okay, well, here's a very extremely challenging situation, so I need to think in a different way than I'm accustomed to. That's certainly something that's exciting, but I fear that the way he's expressing it leads me to that. That's not the conclusion he got
to. That's my fear as well. And I, you know, look, I mean, I've talked to Cliff a bunch of times. He is definitely genuinely a gamer. He's a cool guy. He likes to play. And I feel like he sincerely, at the moment of this interview, had one of those like quick moments where you're like, God, I really am sick of this shit. I get that. I get that he had that response. I just hope that he doesn't like latch on too hard to that and then go back to that, like, I'm just going to beat you up in the game. Because that's happened plenty of times in game design.
Unless he's going indie sometime soon, I would sort of, you know, take those comments with a grain of salt.
Well, I hate to bring everything back to Diablo, but the experience...
But let me.
Proceed to.
But try to stop me.
You know, I can't remember the last time. Maybe it was Halo, the original Halo. It might have been that long ago that I played the same game over and over and over on... ascending difficulty levels. I mean, I've played a game once or twice. I mean, obviously once, but I mean, I played a game like again on another difficulty level. But I can't remember. I mean, Halo, I played it on every difficulty. Well, not easy, but you know what I mean. I played it through in heroic and then legendary.
It's because the AI is awesome in that
game. AI is awesome in that game. And yeah. In Diablo.
Fear. I did Fear that way too, but that was, I mean, I love stuff that Monolith works on.
Well, it is that exact experience that I'm talking about is that, okay.
You made me miss Shogo there really quick.
God, I miss – you know what?
Anyway,
I found my Craig Hubbard signed copy of Shogo, by the way. I was very happy.
Sorry, Jeff. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
It is encountering a new level of challenge that rewrites how you are playing the game. And it works in Diablo because the – play style that you're dealing with is so malleable that there are so many loadouts that are completely applicable and could work that when faced with a new challenge, I am, as I've said before, forced to think. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, I have to handle this differently. So based on the new information, based on the attributes of this elite or that elite or the fact that these guys hit a hell of a lot harder than they ever have before – how can I modify my play style? How can I engage a new skill set both Twitch-wise and intellectually that allows me to overcome that challenge?
You know, we haven't talked about this. Have you tried League of Legends?
I have it installed on my computer.
I think you should probably not try it because...
I think you're right.
I foresee bad things happening to your life, like not showering and...
You assume that I shower now.
Well, you start talking in a language, even more so than Diablo, where I hear people talk about that game and I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
But some of the things you were breaking down there, though, I think – I mean, I say that jokingly. I think that you should – you probably should look at Dota 2 and League of Legends and try one of them because I think that based on what you're talking about, you would really like it.
There was a day when I was like, I'm downloading this. I'm gonna change my life. I'm going to get into League of Legends. And I downloaded it and I installed it and it was like sitting there and I'm like – I don't think I should click that.
Because think about it. Like, the whole MOBA scene extracts that dynamic element and makes it where it replicates it over and over by having it all be driven by a real group of players on each team. And that's the ultimate dynamic, you know, wild card.
Well, I told you last week that I was watching the MLB championship.
And it's awesome.
MLB. MLG.
MLG.
I was also watching baseball, guys. And one of the most fascinating things about the League of Legends stuff that they were showing was these pre-show, like, drafting process, I guess. I don't know anything about the game. Sadly, I'm completely ignorant about that game. But they, like, sit around and they discuss, like, well, he's going, you know, so-and-so, and she's going to go that. So yeah. I better pick this. Oh, well, but if you pick that, then I'm going to pick that. It's like,
they all know their heroes. They know their lanes.
Fascinating.
Exactly. But there's still so much of a dynamic element that enters into it that it's all about those back-and-forth balances that you're talking about. I think.
Yeah.
So if you like that, actually, you should go, but you should just, if you hop into Chatty, there's a regular Shaq battle group, and they're always, I mean, they're pretty good at, like, bringing people in. League of Legends right now. I mean, there's also a Dota 2 thing simultaneously.
Is there anything in Dota that I could sell for real money? Or?
Oh, good God.
No, not yet, nobody. Jeff.
Now you're not going to play.
And on that note.
Someday.
All right, we will take a little break, and we will come back for the final segment here. We got to figure out what we're going to put in there for wrap-ups, and don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with that.
I'm still trying to picture Jeff Dunham in a biker.
Right.
It opens just a door. I just feel like I'm part of this biker.
Right.
I'm part of this biker gang. And like, I join a biker gang. We all love the newest, hottest bikes. Like, I can't wait to see the new Harley.
Right.
Harley. And I go and I sit down for the Nintendo conference and they're like,
right.
Hey, mopeds. Failure is not an option.
Right.
Mopeds are cool. Mopeds.
Cool.
Mopeds. He's not talking to me on my bike. Mopeds are cool. Just not excited about the moped because I'm really interested in the new mopeds.
Failure is an option.
Dude, that was awesome.
And apparently you're going to be joining, when you have kids, you'll be joining a moped club. By the way, I thought one of the interesting comments.
Looking forward to that.
One of the interesting comments from last week's show came from Mr. Manager, who addressed you and Christian.
That's Mr. Manager.
Mr. Manager, who says, I don't understand the perspective, Christian, you and Jeff have, that the Wii U is not being made for you because you're a gamer, right?
Yeah.
And the Wii U likely will have games. It may even have some that you like.
This is true. And I hope so, and I'm excited to play those.
Mm-hmm. Why do you how do you make the argument that it's not for you?
I think that what we were trying to express was that the design concept around which the box seems to have been created doesn't have my interests at heart. My core, I shouldn't use that word because that has connotations that I didn't intend. But it doesn't have the interest that I am most excited about in gaming at its centerpiece, about which the whole design philosophy rotates. I don't worry about someone taking my television. I don't worry about five people in my house, one of them needing to have their own asymmetrical experience. I don't worry about that stuff because it's very rare for those things to happen. So my excitement level about those kinds of experiences is lower than it would be for experiences that are more aimed toward.
And I still don't worry that the moment they give us a great Zelda game or game on it that I'm not going to love it.
I'm not holding my nose and saying I shan't buy a Wii U ever. I'm not being like that. I think people are like saying, why didn't you guys talk about Zombie U? Yes, Zombie U looks cool. I'm excited to play Zombie U. I want to play Zombie U. I want to play New Super Mario Brothers U. There's a lot of games that I'm excited to play. I'm saying as a piece of hardware with the parameters of the hardware, it's not something that I'm like, oh, finally, they made that box, which I expect to be when Sony and Microsoft unveil their new consoles.
Hmm. Well, you know, we always have trouble figuring out Nintendo consoles. And as my SSSSS pointed out, another thing I found fascinating about the Wii U discussion is that he's talking about the gamepad. The gamepad is which I wrote this. I must not have copied. I cut and pasted. I must not have cut and pasted the whole thing. Anyway, basically what he said was how when we originally were talking about the Wii U a year ago, it was all like, how do the people who don't get to use the pad feel? And then this time, now we're talking about this year, we're talking about it as we give the Wii U gamepad to our little brother or the low-rate gamer and get rid of them while everybody else plays with the controllers. And what an interesting flip-flop that is
over
a year.
Well, a lot of that has to do with design, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like what they're doing with the software.
There's
some exceptions, yeah, but for the most part, yeah. It's like, okay, slower friend. You know,
slower friend.
Here's your tablet.
Everyone's got a couple slower friends.
You know?
See, you are in the market for this.
Some people are dating their slower friends.
Oh, Jeff.
Just pointing out.
Some people are creating their slower
not
friends.
Not me. I'm not saying I am. Some people are creating their slower
friends. Yeah, that is true.
Oh my. I just don't even know how to follow that up.
Anyways,
we had some, as long as we're on listener stuff, we had some listener submitted questions to go with Spec Ops as well, which I thought we'd throw at Corey because I set the sheet of paper down and forgot about them. And we addressed a number of them. I felt like we addressed the comparisons to modern shooters, Battlefield, Call of Duty. We got into all that kind of stuff. We got into the narrative stuff. But a couple of things that were down here was the Unbannables ask on Twitter, will there be DLC packages?
Yeah. Oh, we should ban that guy, by the way.
He's unbannable.
Oh, never mind.
You can't even ban him. But I can't reveal what our DLC is going to be, but what I can tell you is that we're going to have a free bonus content pack that comes out just after launch for everybody who buys the game, which is going to contain some co-op missions. So
awesome.
Yeah. So
co-op, like how many player co-op?
Two-player co-op.
Sweet. So the game doesn't ship with co-op. Awesome.
It doesn't ship with co-op.
Awesome. That's awesome.
But we actually had some opportunity towards the end of the project, so it didn't make it on the disc, but to develop some co-op with the systems that we'd created for single player. And
tied
in some elements of our story into that and things like that to give you some backstory. So no matter how you buy the game, no matter where you buy it or when, you'll get access to that free content.
Sweet. I love how this works. If it's not on the disc, you don't have to pay for it. But if it's on the disc, then you have to pay to unlock it. We should make it work like this all the time.
As long as we know the rules.
And then VideoStar asks, what do you think could happen to have us see more inspired original first-person shooter games on the markets? Or is innovation just too risky? And I think that's, you know, that innovation just too risky, which sort of tops off that question you had been talking about.
Yeah, I think we're going to see that coming up here very soon with sort of the new opportunities technology is going to open up for us very soon. I think people are going to push boundaries in ways that we don't expect. Not necessarily peripheral devices, but like you were talking about a minute ago, but, you know, the memory that's allowing us to do more in these scenes and things like that. And some of the lessons that we're learning in this generation I think are going to help out a lot. But for me, like, I would love to see more shooters that, you know, don't pull punches and that really want to express themselves. That really want to, you know, come at us with something new and unique and make a statement, whatever that statement may be, as long as it's something that's meaningful to those people that are developing it. I want to see into their minds and not just sort of play the formula that somehow came out of a bunch of discussions about other games. And so I'm hoping that the new technology gives us some new places to find our inspirations from. But I think that as developers, we're maturing. Like I mentioned before, we want things that are challenging to us. We see some of the patterns that are out there that some people are complaining about. We feel the same way. we play these games. And so, like, I was really happy to have the chance to sort of take some risks with the project, Spec Ops The Line, that we are shipping right now. But I want to see that go a lot further in the next generation coming up here.
Other than Spec Ops, I don't know if you were able to kind of see a lot of stuff at E3 or kept tabs on it. What coming out of E3 is a game that you personally are really excited to get your hands on?
Yeah, I was mostly in my booth we got to show some people some of the co-op stuff I was just talking about and some levels later in the game, which I was really excited about. But there were some things that I saw at E3 that were exciting. I saw this crazy Metal Gear Ninja Robo thing that I thought looked pretty interesting. I saw Lost Planet 3, which I thought, like, especially, you know, looking at the stuff that I've been working on.
Here's your choir on that one.
Yeah, I thought that looked really exciting, very, very polished, and it has a lot of potential. I think I like the direction that they're going in. Let's see. Other than that, I thought the new Planet Side looked pretty exciting.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that very much, but it did.
Super, super adventurous.
A little bit
ambitious.
Super
yeah.
cool.
So ambitious.
So ambitious. But, like, I was only playing with, like, you know, just like 20 people or something like that. And it felt really powerful. It felt, it was beautiful. It looked great. And seeing that on its full scale, I think could be very, very interesting. So.
Awesome.
So, talking about that idea of taking risks and doing different things, one of the things that came up in the wake of E3 was the degree of violence on display. And there's been a lot of debate around this subject. Mm-hmm. And I think that a good bit of it kicked off around Warren Spector's comments that he made to – I think this was also to Gama Sutra. And he said that basically he came away from E3 feeling like we were fetishizing violence. And that we had to get away from ultra-violence and that we're appealing to an adolescent mindset and calling it mature and that it's time to stop. On the other hand, in an interview with GameSpy, PlayStation software product development head Scott Rode talked about how what we're seeing is just a natural evolution of technology, and it's happening in TV and it's happening in film, and we are just able to better and better and better depict what's going on in scenes, and that violence is a part of narrative storytelling that happens. And of course, you know, one of the places that I think one of the game events that has been centered around was the Last of Us demo, mm-hmm. which just had this real brutality to the physical nature of it. And then there was also the Tomb Raider stuff. Well, so what do you guys feel like about this violence debate?
I think one of the interesting points to be made about Last of Us, just briefly, is that I think most internet commentators or fans are reacting to what was shown at the press conference, and most of us who were there and had a chance to see the behind closed doors are reacting to what we saw in the behind closed doors, true, which is markedly different. Anyway, go ahead, Jeff. What were you going
to
say?
Oh, no. I was just coming from someone who didn't get a chance to see either, I've seen the stuff online since then. But it seems to me like it's a game that gives violence a lot more weight than in your average game. Like when you're, limited ammo, the narrative is a lot more dark and you're not trying to, go head to head with a bunch of guys and shoot them all in the face. And then it comes down to a confrontation people see, and it's really brutal and realistic, and it makes them sort of uncomfortable to see that. And I actually think that's a net positive for gaming.
Absolutely.
Like I think that is
– absolutely.
Because – granted, I'll watch old Schwarzenegger movies with anyone, and I love Rambo and all that shit. Fine, that has its place, but
those are the movies he's making now, old Schwarzenegger movies.
Yeah,
starring old Schwarzenegger as decrepit guy.
I'll be in the bathroom.
I have a hypothesis that I wish I had the academic time to really, really, really polish up, because I think that it bears exploring, and I don't know whether it'd be provable, but I feel like there's something to prove here, and it centers around Moore's law and the acceleration of technology and how no other entertainment media has been more impacted by that than video games, because we are a modern era entertainment source. And so we've come up within this era where Moore's law has been applying so rapidly, and we're so far on that curve that what's happened is that technology, as I've been thinking about it in my mind, I see this area where the technology has just run many times further down the development road and maturation cycle than the narrative and storytelling and all of those aesthetic parts that needed to come along with it. And so now you've got this divide between the two, where you've got the ability to do this really incredibly impactful presentation, but you haven't cultured people yet to expect that everything else is going to go along with that. And so it could be perceived as adolescent. And we're very quickly seeing people trying to overcome that. And I think about this in terms of relationships to other medias. And the only one that really, that I can do a good comparison to is, let's take the movie business. And the movie business started, in with the late 1800s with a lamp and a rotating device. And then you had black and white, in black and white, but no sound, voice. And then you had sound, and then you had color, and then you started to have special effects. And just imagine if you had taken De Niro's Taxi Driver and even tried to show that in the 50s. People would have been like, whoa, there would have been rioting in the streets.
Exactly. Imagine Taxi Driver, the video game. Like if somebody actually made a game that had the same narrative resonance as that, about a guy who's basically going fucking nuts.
Yeah.
And put you in that role, and you come out of that thing kind of like, whoa, I'm kind of disturbed by this.
That's the
I now think
is
Taxi Driver was – well, but Taxi Driver was 30 or 40 years ago, and that's in the movie scheme, and we're talking about an industry that's had over a century to evolve, and video games in a couple of decades have hit rocket velocity way past that on the technology side.
You're talking about technology. The base level technology that's employed in a film is a human being. And being can convey emotion and subtlety and nuance. So I mean, it's a little bit apples
and
oranges.
True, but there's an evolution that's definitely taking place. I come from a religious family, so I was always very, very conscious about what ratings movies had. For example, if you look what was rated R in 1970 versus today, it's totally different. And it's happening in other mediums as well. It's happening in TV. I remember the first time I saw an episode of Breaking Bad, I was like, whoa. that's the most brutal thing I've ever seen on TV, and it feels real. And, you know, there was definitely films that were doing that before that.
Right.
But it seems like – I don't know if we're all just getting desensitized together or
there's
if –
there's probably an argument for that.
Or if we're starting to just express ourselves differently because we've had experiences that have pushed us in that direction.
I also – I mean, I actually think there's a lot of truth in what Spector's saying, and maybe it's not a popular opinion here, but I think, you know, we can all enjoy Lollipop Chainsaw, but there's nothing mature about that game.
No,
it's an M-rated game, and it's the most immature game on the market.
But that's not the sort of violence he's talking about, I don't think.
It's the
how is it not? How is that not fetishizing violence? How is that? That's exactly what it's doing.
Because
it's intentionally.
That's cartoon violence. I mean, that's sort of like saying – and I guess there's psychology and assessments that have done the same thing, that like, you know, that sort of stuff that Roadrunner and Coyote get into desensitizes kids to violence, even though it's like a Roadrunner and a Coyote.
Sure.
Right, but
I mean, it's Lollipop Chainsaw. It's a crazy chick in like overdone graphics. It's not supposed to be realistic. She's carrying around a beheaded fucking head.
But at the same time, like if I put that in front of my son, he's gonna probably like playing that game more than he's gonna like playing Spec Ops because of all those beautiful colors and the music and all of the, and those sorts of things. So I can see where people sort of get, you know, worried about that sort of thing. But I'm not worried about it personally.
And we got to be careful not to conflate like mature with adult.
Yeah,
like.
How are you?
Well, okay.
You should say how you want to define those.
Okay,
two,
okay.
Too.
So maturity. When I think mature, I think, okay, these are themes that as a younger person, or things that as a younger person, I interpret through a different lens. And as you grow up and gain life experience, and you look at things through, you know, an older pair of eyes, you get perspective on things, and you understand, you know. Mm-hmm. The weight of different violence. You understand the difference between the violence in Lollipop Chainsaw and Band of Brothers. Like, you get it. They're totally different. And that's the distinction that I would make is I still don't think that, you know, kids have to have to be able to process that information without it fucking them up. And I think, you know, kids get to a certain age and they can do that. But really, bottom line is, you know, exposing kids to violence, even if it's completely ridiculous and, you know, cartoony and over the top, it's an ingrained cultural thing. Like, we don't have – I would be much happier if there was like, you know, you look at primetime TV and there were – you replace half the gunshots with, you know, boobs.
I would also be happy with that.
You know what I mean?
I
think we have a quorum.
Boobs. I think what you're talking about is tone. And – the problem is, and I think it's changing. We're seeing it with Last of Us. I think you're talking about it with Spec Ops: The Line. It's we're only just now getting to the point where game designers are interested in approaching violence tonally in a way that is as your definition of mature is something that is about real life instead of the basis of the most basic of video games is kill or be killed. Kill or be killed creates dramatic tension. It creates a clear goal and clear consequences for not reaching that goal. But when you extrapolate that out, you get a game. You get tag on a dramatic level. But the level of technology that we're putting into place and the level of storytelling now allows us to shift the tone and allow a game to still be a game and to still be kill or be killed, but to put a prism on the context of that, or not a prism, a spotlight, excuse me, on the context of that, so that we can have more interesting experiences, have longer forms of narrative that compete with these other mediums and do it in a more interesting way because I'm actively participating in that. And I think it's exciting now that I think as the average age of gamers and the average age of game developers is advancing, that people are more interested in that. And, and we're seeing these two games. And you don't have to only have one without the other.
That is a big point to me.
You can still have the fun id, not to be confused with the game company, but the pure expression of id of like, wow, it's fun to blow things up.
You can still have Starship Troopers.
Well, I mean, Starship Troopers has some interesting things to say too. But I mean, it's more like it's still enjoying.
But it's ridiculous.
You know,
it's gory.
Toxic
it's got people
Avenger
having their heads bored out. It's got.
Yeah.
It's been cut in half.
You guys, I feel like I'm in pre-production of Spec Ops again.
This is what you guys were talking about, right?
Yeah, this is like the exact debate we were having.
That's awesome.
Having that in Germany is really, really interesting. Where
oh, yeah.
Like
no
the ratings board is extremely concerned with the context behind what you're doing. Hmm. So like a game like Lollipop Chainsaw is going to have a tough time in Germany.
It'll be androids and they'll be bleeding oil.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how it
but
works.
But Spec Ops The Line, for example, can release there because it has a context behind what's going on there with the story and the reason why we're portraying this violence. And so, that's a really healthy debate. And there's such a different perspective between the European perspective on that and the American one.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think that the challenge here is not taking what Warren said out of context and applying it into a bunch of different games and then thinking about how that relates. And here's where I'm going with that. It's that I think that one of the things that even we as gamers have been reluctant to come along the curve to is to take games seriously, is to take those narrative beats that people have, like Corey, have put a lot of love and care into and take them seriously, because I am still playing a shooter and I've been trained that my shooter is just fluff and throwaway, and then I don't pay attention to those things. And that is something that, like, we just have to – that was where I was talking about that curve thing, you know? Like the technology took off and we were playing all these shooters and they look the way they look. And we just haven't had long enough where we played games that were really meaningful and had a strong narrative influence to get us to the same point. But we've been playing shooters all the way back since Castle Wolfenstein.
Sure.
The problem is, I think people reduce this argument to, you don't want to let me have my fun. You don't want to let me play my fun kill 'em games. And I'm just – all I've ever been saying when this topic comes up is that we have one kind of thing, and video games are really, for the most part, one kind of thing. And it would be great if it was more of a smorgasbord.
Like McGonagall's talking about. I mean, we got to get past being – like the interaction in games just being put the crosshair on an enemy and pull a trigger.
Yeah.
And that's cool. I mean, we've got some attempts. Obviously, Mass Effect, a large bulk portion of the game has turned conversations into a game mechanic where you're choosing responses and trying to get the correct, you know, emotional responses out of different characters and branching paths that happen off of that. And
that's why I kept singing the praises of L.A. Noir.
And that's
– I mean, reading facial expression, what an awesome game mechanic, you know. I love the boldness of that, and I want more. I want more.
Now sing it.
And I think that's cool. And I think at the same time, when these things come up, is we've got to be also willing to start step up to the plate and say, you know what, actually, no, you're right. Last of Us is really brutal and violent, and that's because the situation he's in is completely desperate, and you want to experience this level of, wow, I'm fighting for my life and I'm desperate, but I don't even have anything to fight for anymore because everything I loved is gone.
Like Tomb Raider is a really interesting example because we actually have an iteration that's much, much different from earlier.
Yeah.
And so like the trade-off there between, you know, this realistic, grounded, physical character that's actually going through believable scenarios versus, you know, boobs. And
I love the old Tomb Raider.
I do too. I do too. It's a lot of fun. And
don't take boobs away from Garnet. It's very upset.
But I think like you said, there's got to be a space for both of those things. And in other mediums, there is.
Yeah.
Well, and to be fair, they both have boobs in them. It's just one of them. You're not paying as much attention to the boobs.
Sure.
So we didn't talk about the game.
Speak for yourself.
And I wanted to, but we're going to go on because we're getting to the end of the show. And for those of you who ask, we do actually like to keep the show to a regular length. But one of the things that's really interesting in Ghost Recon Future Soldier is that there's a scene. There's several times when you are engaged in active combat in high-density civilian populations, and it is intense as shit. And one of the mechanics I suspect that they probably wanted it to be a little more intense, but through testing decided it was just too frustrating for you to be killing civilians and it didn't have the right impact. So you've got this grenade that you can toss that once you do like magic sonar and puts a red outline around the bad guys. And I had read about this in forums before playing it because I didn't play it right when it came out. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to do my best to not use that. So one of the scenes this scene will stick with me, I think, for a little while. There's a scene where you're pushing through a Pakistani urban environment and you're trying to chase down an insurgent team, and there are civilians running down the street. There's abandoned cars. There's shit just gone completely crazy. And I didn't throw out one of these homing grenades, which would have like changed it all. And it was so nerve-wracking to be, you know, bounding from cover to cover and then also simultaneously trying to keep identification of where my three squad mates were. And then also as guys were coming or as people were running down, you know, little corridors towards me, friend or foe identify them.
That's awesome.
It was intense. Awesome. Yeah. It was really, really intense. And I was
soldiers
like,
soldiers go through that shit.
I wish there had been, I mean, the whole scene lasts maybe 3 minutes by the time you get to the end of it. And like, there's parts where there are people sniping at you and you can't identify where you literally are sitting there, like trying to just see a tracer come by or hear it hit someplace so you can start to get any sort of idea where stuff's coming from. And it's super intense. Super intense. And I went back for fun and played it with a grenade, and it's not fun. I mean, it's just like you throw the grenade out. Everybody has a red highlight. You know that, oh, that guy doesn't have a red highlight. I don't shoot them.
Yeah. Sort of takes the element of choice out of it for you because everything's so present and aware at that moment.
Yeah.
And that sounds like something that, you know, would be added after – like you do what you said, like design-wise. You'd be like, no, dude, this is going to be a really intense scene and blah, blah, blah. And
I mean, keep in mind Future Soldier is about all these tech. I mean, you got all kinds of gear.
You got Spec Ops, you're not going to have a homing grenade. You're just going to have a refugee camp and shit's going to hit the fan.
Sure.
It's intense. That's intense. All right. This has been great. Corey, thanks very much. Yeah, we are going to hit with finishing moves to close her off.
Finishing moves.
All right. And we will let Corey riff her off because he is the guest of honor today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Basically, I just wanted to say that I'm really excited for the game to come out next week, and I hope you pick it up. And, you know, I hope you pay attention to those subtle things that we were talking about today as far as that dark and mature narrative and the progression of these characters as they go down the path into the heart of darkness.
I do too. I hope it all comes together for me. I'm eagerly hoping.
I'm so much more excited to play it now than I have ever been. It's really cool.
It's very cool.
Jeff Cannata, your finishing move, sir.
So, big week if you're a fan of tabletop gaming and also have an iOS device. Not only is there Duels of Planeswalkers 2013, which I'm so addicted to, one of my favorite board games in the universe just got an excellent iOS adaptation, La Havre by Uwe Rosenberg.
I've heard you talk about this one before.
It's a great, great game, and it just got an iOS release. It's, I think, $4.99, and packs a hell of a lot of game. It seems very complex, but it's a very simplistic game that has a lot of nuance and a lot of deep strategy. I highly recommend checking that game out. I haven't had a chance to see if the tutorial is very good. Hopefully it is. It's a fantastic game. It's called La Havre. That's L-E space H-A-V-R-E.
Cool. And Mr. Jeff Mattis?
Yes. So speaking of iOS, just real quick, I know the platformer on iOS devices is always sort of like, oh my God, why are they doing that? But I played a really good one with some really cool swipe controls called Project 83313. I think it's trending pretty well in the App Store. So anyway, might be free still. They were running a sale on it, so grab it. The only other thing that I wanted to touch on was I've been playing through Rain Slick Precipice of Darkness 3.
Oh, really?
The Penny Arcade thing. And it's done by Z-Board Games. Really good. But the thing – I'll talk about it more at some point in the future when I'm finished with it. But there was some kerfluffle today where – so the PC version is still slated to come out next week. The Xbox Live Indie Games version or the Xbox Live Arcade version is slated was slated to come out the same day, has been pushed – because in playtesting, peer review, whatever, they discovered that if while you're saving the game, you pull the memory card out of the fucking Xbox, the thing will crash. And apparently that's a no-go.
Yeah, it's a no-go.
I'm like, really? Like so that's the reason for the delay. It'll be resubmitted again in a week or so. That's fucking ridiculous.
Oh, you ought to see the standard sheets a developer gets.
I know. That's some fun stuff.
You ought to see any of that crap.
So I don't know. I guess my point is if you pull the memory card out while you're saving a game, you deserve what happens to you.
That was the best finishing move ever. If you pull a memory card out while you're trying to save a game, you deserve what happens to you.
What if my cat did it? Oh, Fluffy.
Make a YouTube video, you'll get a million hits, and monetize it, you'll be fine. On that silly note, mine's just real simple. My little brother is riding again this year in the Children's Hospital of Colorado's annual ride for charity. Last year, you guys helped a ton. He's just aiming to hit $400, and it would be fantastic if you could help out. I will put a link in the Shack News thread, and that's it. Like, yeah, it would be great if you could help him out. He has been the benefactor with one of his kids was taken care of there at the Children's Hospital in Denver, and he's been the supporter ever since. And that is it. Thank you very much to Corey Davis Jaeger, all the way in from Germany. Spec Ops The Line is out next week. If you want to keep up with it, you can do that on the Twitter account for 2K Games, which is at 2K Games, the number 2 letter K Games, or on their YouTube channel where they have a number of Spec Ops The Line videos. As always, Mr. Jeff Cannata is on YouTube and Revision 3 with The Totally Rad Show or totallyradshow.com.
Yeah, you can double dip on Corey Davis. He's going to be on our show next week. And we talk about different stuff, guys. It's different and it's awesome. And we're playing the game live.
And Mr. Jeff Mattis, of course, always on Twitter as well, at Jeff Mattis, on our blog, The Indie Games Channel, and on Shack News, and on this very show.
See.
There you go.
Yes.
Thanks, of course, to the Atlantis Group, Micah in the Booth, Del Rio, and 2K Games for letting Corey come over. It's been a great show. Thanks very much, everybody. That is it. That's your weekend confirmed, and we are Ghost. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Work so hard that you know we play harder. For me to see what was going down, my body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hit me with another round. I gotta feel she's ready. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.